Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the predictions are coming in now for the ruling on the two gay marriage cases heard in the Supreme Court. What are the real factors that will drive the justices' decisions? Then, the planet is facing the worst spate of extinction since the loss of the dinosaurs. Dozens of species are going extinct every day. Should science bring back those species through cloning? Many are seeking clues from the hearings on gay marriage that were before the Supreme Court last week in efforts to predict how the justices will rule on the cases. What are the real factors that drive judicial decisions? Sanford Levinson is a professor of political science and law at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Constitutional Faith, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It, and most recently, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. Lawrence Baum is professor of political science at Ohio State University. He is the author of numerous books, including The Supreme Court, Judges and Their Audiences, and The Puzzle of Judicial Behavior. Samuel Markeson also joins us. He is a professor of law at the University of Louisville at the Louis D. Brandeis School of Law. He's also the author of Original Sin, Clarence Thomas and the Failure of the Constitutional Conservatives. Thank you for being with us. It's great to have two of you back and great to have Professor Markeson joining us for the first time. We've had a lot of predictions and a lot of media suggesting how they believe these two cases will go. There's a prediction that there will be a win for gay couples in the DOMA case, but a potential loss. Potential, I say, because it seems there are a couple of predictions going on with the Prop 8 case. Let's start, Sam Markeson, with whether or not you agree with these predictions and why or why not.
Well, I think in the game of predictions, you're going out on a limb that's very likely to break out from under you, but with that caveat in mind. My guess is that I probably agree with what seems to be a developing consensus on Windsor, the DOMA case, that the court will, perhaps with some divided reasoning between the federalism issue we've heard so much about, that the federal government perhaps should not intrude into an area of traditional state authority by refusing to defer to the definition of marriage that a state chooses, if it chooses, to recognize same-sex couples' marriages, that combined with some equal protection norms that were urged by both counsel for Windsor and the Solicitor General, that those sort of twin arguments may win over a majority of the justices. I'm not quite as convinced on the Prop 8 consensus that that's going to be a loss, although it may depend on how you define loss. It seems to me that Justice Kennedy, if he is, as most believe, the swing vote there, which I think is right, that I think he may send a very strong signal that if he does vote to uphold Proposition 8, that it's very conditional, that it's dependent upon the fact that California recognizes all of the same rights or most of the same rights of marriage, the same responsibilities and obligations of marriage for same-sex couples, that that's how the California Supreme Court has interpreted the aftermath of Proposition 8. And that is sort of the basis on which he finds that California has not violated equal protection. And that may send a very strong signal to other states that their much more draconian rules, that their failure to recognize any rights at all, are vulnerable to attack. And that may be the, with him being the swing vote, could be the way in which he views the keeping the democratic process alive by triggering that democratic process in those states, triggering those states to have to reconsider their, what we call mini DOMAs, their state law prohibitions on any recognition of same-sex couples' relationships. So I think that would be a loss, certainly in California, but it would sort of be an earthquake around the rest of the country in a lot of states like here where I am in Kentucky to have to rethink their non-recognition regimes. So that would be sort of one way I've been thinking that Justice Kennedy may sort of find a way to keep the process alive, to respect what he sees as a cautious approach, but it would, of course, be a loss in the Prop 8 case itself.
Didn't he question whether or not the court should be hearing this case, like on a question of if it was the appropriate time? Do you have a sense that that might come into play in his final decision?
I think we would know on that sooner rather than later. I think it's certainly something he had in his, certainly percolating in his mind. He asked that question more than once about whether this was the case had been properly granted. I think Justice Kennedy would certainly have preferred to have a case from a state like Kentucky or one of the other many states that have much more strict bans on marriage than California does. There were several questions from Justice Kennedy and others about somehow California being punished for having a system that is more accepting of marriage, or at least same-sex relationships with civil unions, than other states which don't. And he thought, and Chief Justice Roberts thought, that seemed to turn the proper analysis on its head. I think Justice Kennedy would have preferred a challenge from a state that has no recognition whatsoever. I think he thought that would have been an easier case to start the court on this road of thinking about the marriage issue. So I think that's certainly a possibility, but I think it would be a difficult one for him to reach. As I said, I think we'll know sooner rather than later, because if the court is going to dismiss, either on standing grounds or just dismiss the writ as improvidently granted, that would certainly not take them nearly as long as reaching the merits would take.
Sandy Levinson, what's your take?
I think that for institutional reasons, I'd be interested in Larry's assessment on this, the court is unlikely to ditch the case in a way that they appear to be exercising discretion on grounds of, you know, they wish they had more time or something like that, because then I think they really would expose themselves to a charge of sheer cowardice in an attempt to duck the hot potato. What I can easily imagine they're doing is dismissing the case on standing grounds. That is to say that there is nobody who can trigger review at the Supreme Court, that both cases are extraordinarily peculiar, and in both cases you don't have a genuine case in controversy between, on the one hand, the state of California and the plaintiffs, and in the other hand, the United States and Ms. Windsor, who wants her tax money back. What you have in the California case are some disgruntled losers, or that is the winners in the original Proposition 8, who claim to have a right to trigger federal judicial review. And here's where it really gets very technical. The state of California has held that they do have standing, but I think ultimately the Supreme Court will want to make that decision for itself. And it wouldn't surprise me if, for a mixture of sheerly tactical and prudential reasons, but also technical legal reasons, there would be an agreement just to throw away the case, get it out of there, on grounds there's no proper plaintiff. The court did this notably in 2004 when it had the Under God decision, also from the Ninth Circuit. My view, for what it's worth, is the Ninth Circuit was absolutely correct in deciding that Under God violates the Establishment Clause. It's also clear that that would have been just a huge hot potato for the Supreme Court to decide on the merits. So they simply made up, from my perspective, a technical standing rule that the father didn't have standing to make the claim on behalf of his daughter. So I can easily imagine they're coming up with what looks like a technical legal reason, not a discretionary reason, but a technical legal reason to say that they just don't have this case properly in front of them and hope that it'll go away for a number of years, that in fact California will pass an initiative referendum in the next 2 years that will just get rid of any remaining doubt on that score, and other states will be likewise. With the other case as well, you have this anomaly that there is no conflict between the United States and the litigant suing the United States. Both of them agree that the statute is unconstitutional, so the defense of the statute is being made by lawyers for the House of Representatives. And the court on its own appointed, actually a friend of mine, Vicki Jackson, from the Harvard Law School, to address the standing issue. And she came to the conclusion that the constitutional House of Representatives have no standing. And Chief Justice Roberts made the rather snarky, though I think somewhat understandable comment that the Obama administration should have had the courage of its convictions and just said, we're not going to enforce this law because we think it's unconstitutional. Instead, what the administration has said is, we think it's unconstitutional, but we really want the Supreme Court to issue an opinion saying that it's unconstitutional. Why should they, from one technical perspective? Now, I think the politics are different with regard to the California case. There may be a collective desire just to push it away and say that there is nothing to be gained for the court in terms of its institutional power to tackle this right now. With regard to DOMA, I think it's actually a quite different sort of calculation. I have no doubt there's a majority on the Supreme Court who believe that DOMA is unconstitutional. I also have very, very little doubt that the Supreme Court would pay almost no cost in ruling that it's unconstitutional. The problem is that I would be very, very surprised if there are five votes who agree on why it's constitutional. I think that the so-called liberals in the court believe it's unconstitutional because it violates norms of equality. I think that Justice Kennedy, and for all I know, maybe one of the other conservatives in the court, believe it's unconstitutional because it violates the reserved interests of the states under a federalism analysis. It wouldn't surprise me if they decide to go ahead and decide the case on the merits, and they don't have to. They could kind of embarrass the Obama administration if they wanted and say they're not going to decide it at all. But if they do decide to decide it on the merits, it wouldn't surprise me at all if you end up having four votes in behalf of the equality argument and one or two votes in behalf of the federalism argument. That will add up to six votes that it's unconstitutional, but there will be no opinion of the court agreeing on why it's unconstitutional.
Well, you bring up a lot of interesting points here, and Larry Baum, this is perfect for you, I think. One is that it looks like the court is faced with a no-win situation in terms of the Prop 8 case, and that it has an option to potentially embarrass an administration if it wants, which that had, of course, kicked it back to the court instead of taking a very strong stand itself. You're a scholar of judicial behavior, decision-making. What do you think is the primary factor or factors that will determine a case like this and DOMA?
I think Sandy has made some very good points about the kinds of things that the justices will be thinking about. To me, the interesting thing is that it may be a much simpler case for some justices than for others. For the most conservative justices, their view is that the lower courts in both these cases, in supporting same-sex marriage, got it wrong as a matter of public policy and as a matter of law. I suspect that these were the justices who were most interested in hearing these two cases, simply because they wanted to reverse what they saw as very bad decisions on the part of the lower courts. My guess is they're not terribly worried about institutional considerations. They just want to make what they see as wrong decisions right. For the liberal members of the court, and I think for Justice Kennedy, it's much more complicated. And something that's hanging over them in a way is Roe versus Wade. There is a widespread perception, not universally accepted, but accepted by many people, that the court moved too far too fast when it struck down the abortion laws of 46 states all at once and transformed the law of abortion in the country. And Justice Ginsburg certainly has expressed the point of view that she felt the court made a mistake in making what she sees as a precipitous move. And I wouldn't be surprised if some of the other justices share that point of view. Well, the question for them then is, if they do feel, as a matter of law and policy, that prohibition and non-recognition of same-sex marriage is a bad thing, the question is, would they run into the same kind of backlash that they perceive as having followed Roe versus Wade? I think that makes their calculations in the case much more complicated than that of the most conservative members of the court. Do we advance what we see as a desirable legal and policy goal by taking a strong stand, or do we act more cautiously in the fear that we will create a backlash that would work against what is our goal. And I think for reasons that both Sam and Sandy referred to, those kinds of considerations and that kind of difficulty apply especially to the California case, probably much less to the federal case, but I don't think it's absent there as well. And I think for that reason, and I think Sandy laid this out very well, it might be very attractive to the justices, or at least the justices in the left and the middle of the court, to let the California case go without actually deciding it on the merits, though perhaps not to worry quite so much about that for the federal case.
This is Sandy. I basically agree with Larry, but only basically. There are some disagreements. I don't think the Roe analogy or the Brown versus Board analogy with backlash necessarily works very well, in part because it's very hard for me to see exactly what the backlash would look like. With Brown, it's not only that you could mobilize a political movement in opposition to desegregation, but you also had the creation of white segregation academies that had profound consequences on public education. With abortion, you had, again, the organization of a militant political movement, but there were also things that state legislatures could do to try to retard abortions. And, of course, that battle goes on now most dramatically in North Dakota just this week. With regard to same-sex marriage, first of all, I don't see the organization of any newly invigorated political movement around same-sex marriage, because I think one of the real anomalies of the case is what Chief Justice Roberts mentioned. I think it was a rather stupid comment, but he challenged Roberta Kaplan in the Windsor case, saying, you know, isn't it the case basically that gays and lesbians now have just equal power, perhaps from Roberts' perspective, even inordinate power in the ordinary political process? And I think what he's responding to is just this kind of breaking of a dam in almost literally the last month with regard to the number of people who are now willing to endorse it. And my own view, if one is engaged in straight out flat political analysis, my hunch is that professional Republicans are praying that the Supreme Court strikes down DOMA precisely so that won't force Republicans in the House and Senate to have to take a stand on repealing it. I think repealing DOMA now is a winner for the Democratic Party in the general electorate. DOMA has become a real albatross around the Republicans' neck. So I think it's an interesting kind of tension between, first of all, abstract legal views and abstract notions of the role of the court. It may be that Ruth Ginsburg, because of her personal biography, is fixated on the response to Roe, and rightly or wrongly analogizes this a great deal.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we are talking about the factors that will likely influence the Supreme Court in its decision on the two gay marriage cases. Larry Baum, do you want to respond to that before we pass it back to Sam? And in your response, I wanted to also engage you on some of these other factors, all of these things that kind of come together that mix with the policy ends that justices try to put forward.
Well, let me begin by responding to what Sandy said, because I think there's a great deal to what he said. Certainly there is a strong tide moving in one direction on this issue, and it might well be that there's only a limited potential for backlash. The only addendum I would say is that there's still a very large proportion of the population that opposes same-sex marriage that would be outraged by a sweeping decision, and that if they couldn't undo the decision, which they probably could not in any way, might still use their power in other ways that some of the justices might prefer that they not do. The other thing I would say is the justices on the left of the court may exaggerate the potential for harm to the court and to this cause. I think Sandy is right that they may not have a great deal to worry about. They still might worry about it anyway, but I'd give a lot of weight to his judgment. It might be that there is not a great deal for them to worry about. Now, as far as the justices' perspectives are concerned, one of the things about the difference between the court's conservatives and liberals is, although there's been a great deal of talk recently about how the country is moving in one direction and the justices don't want to be left behind, I think the most conservative justices don't care about being left behind. The people whose opinions they care about are people who share their view on issues such as same-sex marriage. And so even if they find themselves in a minority, even if they find the tide is moving in the other direction, that's not going to bother them.
In fact, it seems like psychologically they like that position.
Oh, I think that's exactly right. Feeling embattled, but also at the same time having a cheering section that's behind them. It's a kind of nice situation to be in. For justices on the left of the court, and maybe even more for Justice Kennedy, there would be some concern about being left behind as history moves on. A fear that this would look like a retrograde decision when the dust settles. And for them, I think they are more sensitive to the way things seem to be moving politically, as Sandy described. They're really responding to different audiences. In a sense, it's a broader audience and a more complicated audience for Justice Kennedy and the justices on the liberal side of the court.
This is Sam. One thing we could look at in just terms of Justice Kennedy's way of thinking about this is to analogize to or look at what he has done in the affirmative action or race-conscious governmental decision-making context. If you look at what he's done in cases like Parents Involved, he keeps saying that he is willing to allow diversity, for example, to be a compelling governmental interest, but he won't really say that any particular use of race meets his standard. So he keeps sort of tantalizingly holding the ball out there without providing the vote or providing enough guidance to tell, for example, school districts or university admissions committees what they need to do. So, you know, he sort of make the commitment that you would hope he would make to provide the fifth vote, either to shut that door or to actually allow for race to be used to actually achieve diversity. And he keeps holding that out there without committing to either side. That's the model, I think, in terms of his caution that we might want to look to see how he might go here, to want to, again, as I think Larry rightly points out, not want to seem retrograde. I think that's definitely on his mind, but at the same time, not wanting to be the one to completely disappoint an audience that I think he does really care about on the more conservative side of the court. I think Sandy is exactly right that the court would have a lot of trouble just punting the case and seeming cowardly, and that would have to be Kennedy who ends up forcing them to do that by not being willing to decide the California case, I think the more likely to do that in. So I think Kennedy is sort of in a spot where he almost has to decide to do something, and if he has to decide to do something, you get a situation in which I think he's going to almost have to decide something that leaves him trying to please both audiences, and then in effect leaving neither one satisfied, as I think he really has left neither one satisfied in the area of race and the use of race in things like school assignment policies and university admissions decisions. If we're going to look for a signal or something in his particular history, that's the one that gives me the one that I would look to as giving us perhaps the clearest signal of how he's likely to dissatisfy both sides.
So in essence, trying to split the baby, you're thinking. That sounds like Sandy Levinson coming back in. Please jump right in.
I think, unfortunately, one has to bring up the elephant in the room, which is that you have a court, the majority of which is Roman Catholic. And I think that when one is referring to the conservatives, and this is not true, of course, of Sotomayor, and in some ways is less true about Kennedy, but with regard to the other four, they probably themselves believe that homosexuality is sinful and that they will have problems writing a decision saying that basically it is up to the political process to decide whether or not this is acceptable. After all, the new pope took a very strong stand in Argentina, and the Catholic Church has made this a defining issue, and I don't think one should ignore it's extremely indelicate to talk about, but I don't think that one can completely ignore the religious factor in these cases.
Larry Baum, how often does religion actually come into play in justices' decisions?
Well, I think that's something that's very hard to generalize about. We're talking about people who, like everybody else, are influenced by a range of experiences and influences that have operated on them, and the effects of something like religion can be very substantial. At the same time, as Sandy suggested, within any religious group, like any other group, there's going to be a fair amount of diversity of points of view. And that makes, I think, rather difficult to make judgments about the impact of something like religion, though Sandy's certainly quite right to raise it as one possible influence.
And Sam Markison, last word.
I think if you look at the difference between Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia in Lawrence versus Texas, where Justice Scalia was the crusader, if you will, not to put a religious spin on it in that way exactly, but was the crusader and very strongly and harshly anti-gay, whereas Justice Thomas simply said that if he were a legislator, he would vote to strike down these laws, which he called uncommonly silly, these sodomy laws. There's a strong difference, and I think it shows that Larry's point that you can't always necessarily assume that religion dictates someone's personal attitudes, but sometimes their jurisprudence leads them to the same conclusion, but a very different attitude that can be expressed on the court. So I'm not sure that you can generalize, but no, I do at some level agree with Sandy that it's something that is going to lurk and influence. Justice Scalia certainly is very open in expressing his in public speeches, in presentations, in talking to audiences, and allowing religion to that voice to come out. And I think it certainly influences him, so it's certainly going to be there in at least some of the justices' thinking.
Interesting, given the Constitution on religion. Thank you for joining us and sharing your thoughts with our listeners. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Sanford Levinson is a professor of political science and law at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Constitutional Faith and Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It. Lawrence Baum is professor of political science at Ohio State University. He is the author of numerous books, including The Supreme Court and The Puzzle of Judicial Behavior. Samuel Markison is a professor of law at the University of Louisville at the Louis D. Brandeis School of Law. He's also the author of Original Sin, Clarence Thomas and the Failure of the Constitutional Conservatives. When we come back, should science bring back some species from extinction? Stay tuned.
The drumfish, they beach themselves in Harukari. The blackbirds, they fell in thousands from the sky. Their red wings streaming down from the higher seas, deflected by the ground. They crown the sun, they crown the sun.
Hello, you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Planet Earth is facing the worst spate of extinction since the loss of the dinosaurs, according to the Center for Biological Diversity. Dozens of species are going extinct every day, and more face extinction with the onset of climate change. These realities have given rise to some scientists exploring the possibility of de-extinction, bringing back some species through cloning. Should it be done? Is it ethical? Is it practical? We're joined by three experts. Michael Archer is a professor of biological, earth, and environmental sciences at the University of New South Wales. He has published more than 300 scientific journal articles focusing on the ecology and evolution of past and present, and has been working to bring back some extinct animals. John Weens is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona and author of numerous publications and the book The Ecology of Bird Communities. He is also a former curator at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History and has served as editor for a number of scientific journals. Carl Zimmer also joins us. He's an award-winning lecturer at Yale University and the author of 13 books, including his latest, A Planet of Viruses, and Evolution, the Triumph of an Idea. His articles have appeared in the New York Times, Time Magazine, National Geographic, and Scientific American. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start with what the scope is that we're facing with regards to mass extinction on the planet. I understand it's pretty unprecedented. Michael Archer, is this something you can help us to understand?
I'm a paleontologist, and certainly we've been documenting the dreadful outcomes of the previous five mass extinctions the planet suffered. Sometimes it's taken out 85% of the creatures on the planet. But there are intimations already that the sixth great extinction is underway and we're the cause. And the rate at which things are going extinct at the moment appears as unprecedented as anything we've ever seen before. It's roughly the equivalent of when that meteor came in and took out the big non-flying dinosaurs.
Except for we don't have a meteor right now.
Well, we're the meteor, unfortunately. And we're really hitting the planet hard. It's a thing we have to take seriously into consideration. You know, if it's us doing it, then we've got to really ask ourselves, do we know what we're doing here? One of the footnotes to this that's disturbing is in the previous five mass extinctions, on average, it takes 10 million years for the planet to stabilize its ecosystems again. And you really have to ask, are we prepared to have that happen on the other side of what we're doing on the planet at the moment?
I know climate change is a big cause of extinction. What are the other activities that we are doing that is creating this problem?
One of the saddest things, unfortunately, has to do with what we perceived 10,000 years ago was the appropriate way for humans to feed themselves. And that meant we started to focus on a very few species that we could grow and stockpile, and through this, increase our own numbers. This is agriculture. In order to get agriculture, every continent on which this has been inflicted, we've swept aside the natural ecosystems and the species along with them in order to plant very few of these foreign species that were introduced to all the other continents. Australia was one of the last ones to have this affliction, but it's suffering now. We've lost 18 of our precious mammals, largely because of land clearing. But then along with that, of course, we have introduced onto every continent a few animal species that we have valued, like sheep and cattle, and moved all the natives aside until eventually they've had no room to survive. And we see this terrible cascade of extinctions following hard on the heels of agriculture.
John Weens.
You know, my understanding is that we're estimating now that we're going to lose between maybe 50%, maybe 67% of all the species that are on the planet now, even though we don't have a clear idea of how many species that is. I think Michael's exactly right. The big problem seems to be habitat destruction, or at least people are estimating that we're going to lose half or two-thirds of all the species on the planet just considering habitat destruction alone. And that's not sort of thinking about climate change. It's sort of a wild card. We don't know what it's going to do. But it's particularly frightening because we can set up reserves and national parks to protect habitats, obviously from habitat destruction, but then lots of species may go extinct inside those reserves and national parks because of climate change.
Carl Zimmer.
The dire situation that we're facing is actually causing conservation biologists to give serious thought to the traditional ways that they have tried to preserve species. As John mentioned, the traditional thing would be to set up a preserve. But if climate totally changes the conditions in that preserve, then you haven't done much good. And so one idea that people have is that you might move some of those species to places where they might have a better chance of surviving, sometimes called assisted migration. But the problem there is that there may not necessarily be any place to move them where they have all the right conditions to survive. So conservation biology is really, these biologists are really grappling with just how truly serious the situation is.
And so scientists are exploring all these different aspects of it. And one of them that triggered this program today specifically dealt with the de-extinction efforts. Michael Archer, you're one of the leaders on this. What are the advances scientifically that are making it possible to bring animals back from extinction, or maybe not even just animals, maybe plant species?
Yeah, there's an awful lot of opportunities that are opening up. I raised this question, back in about 2000 when I was very interested in knowing whether we could recover the DNA from one of Australia's iconic animals. It's kind of our king of beasts, called the thylacine or Tasmanian tiger. And when I asked, you know, could we get that DNA back out of a pickled specimen that we had, which theoretically was possible, there was just laughter, and that was, you know, barely 13 years ago or 23 years ago. Now, technology has streaked ahead. George Church, in his book Regenesis, has outlined many of the new technologies, the new machines that can work with fragmented DNA. There is letter-by-letter gene replacement techniques that enable you to work with, say, the genetic understanding of a living animal and change it step-by-step to match the recovered DNA from an extinct animal. So there are so many new and exciting things happening. There are other people also traveling under this banner of de-extinction that are involved in kind of trying to deconstruct living animals to see what's in their ancestry behind the living animal. The living animal still carries the genes of extinct ancestors. And increasingly, it's possible to, through selective breeding, to start to recover those ancient genes and hopefully begin to bring back one of the prehistoric animals. There are other groups that are looking at even de-extincting environments. I mean, we're talking here now about bringing back a mammoth or a thylacine or a frog, but it's also possible to think about bringing back whole ecosystems. Much of the instability that affects the planet at the moment is because we've had what are called trophic cascades. You extinct some key animal, and then a whole lot of other things that depended on it also disappear. So there are other people working on trying to, for example, bring back the Pleistocene world that used to be here 10,000 years ago and see if you can reinstall it in Siberia. These are all such exciting projects, and nobody's laughing anymore. They're possible.
There are some people who think that maybe it's not really practical or not really ethical. You've responded that you think it is ethical and practical. Let's start with that argument.
I think it's more than practical and possible. I do have a very strong feeling that if we can see the finger of man, if you like, as the responsible factor for why some of these iconic species are gone, then I feel we have a moral responsibility, and I'd even argue a moral imperative, if we can be smart human to start to undo the time when we played inappropriately like gods and exterminated species, then I think we have this moral imperative to try to do that. So that's my view, is that this isn't just toys or fun or just seeing what we can do. We're actually trying to fix what we broke. And that, to me, is very important.
John Weins, you've expressed some skepticism about this. What are your concerns?
I think it's actually a great and a wonderful thing. But at the same time, I don't think it should be the highest priority. I think the highest priority should be to preserve species in their natural environments. And when we do that, that's how we're going to preserve the maximum number of species in the shortest amount of time with the minimum effort and the minimum cost. And I think that's the most important thing. As some people say, try to save all the pieces rather than trying to put things back together again. I think the second line of defense is zoos, you know, once things are still alive but maybe can't be in the wild anymore. And then I think the de-extinction is a wonderful third route, but I would say that it should be the lowest priority.
Can I pop into that one, John? I agree with you about that. But on the other hand, if we do this sequentially, if we say, first, we're going to try to keep them in the wild, and if that doesn't work, well, hang on, we'll keep them alive in the zoos. And if that doesn't work, oh, well, let's go back to square one and maybe try to bring something back from the dead. But these are parallel activities. I don't see them as alternatives. I can't see any reason why, because different monies are involved, different kinds of support are going on here, why we shouldn't be trying de-extinction projects simultaneously with maintaining that commitment to conserving living species. And in the process, what we're finding, what I heard at the Revive and Restore and De-Extinction events National Geographic was running, were that people are talking about cross-species cloning. This is a key to de-extinction projects. And that actually is an extremely important tool for modern conservationists to increase the numbers of endangered species by taking cells from the endangered species, popping them into a common related species, and getting more of the endangered species back into the world. So I see these as compatible strategies rather than alternatives.
Carl Zimmer, what is it that you're hearing from the rest of the scientific community?
The other people I'm talking to are discussing these very issues. These things are on their mind as well. And another thing that comes up in my discussions with scientists is the question of what it really means to bring something back from extinction. Because, you know, if you just make one animal Well, that's a scientifically an impressive feat, but one animal is not a species. A species is a viable population that can sustain itself. And, you know, if you create just enough to survive in a zoo, for example, well, you know, some scientists would say, well, that's kind of functionally extinct. And we actually have some species right now where they're basically only in zoos. And so it's not really what you think of when you think of biodiversity. So really, ultimately, the real test of de-extinction for a lot of scientists would be actually being able to put something back out in the wild. And there again, it's a very tricky issue, because if they became extinct because of something that happened in their habitat, as we've just discussed, well, if that habitat is still a mess, then you might just watch them going extinct again. And there are diseases that have broken out that have driven a number of species extinct, a number of frog species, for example. They're still out there, and nobody has any good way to cure these diseases that are caused by fungi. So if you were to bring back a frog, as Dr. Archer is doing, who's to say that you put it out in the wild and they all die of the same fungus again? So these are the kinds of questions that de-extinction is raising.
John Weems?
I would come back to that idea, and I agree with both Carl and Mike, but I think there does need to be this hierarchy, that the first and most important priority is preserving the habitat. Again, like Carl said, if you de-extinct something, you have to have a place to put it besides just a zoo or a laboratory. There has to be a habitat for it. There has to be an environment. And so I think that is the first priority in terms of preservation. And I agree with Michael that these things can be going on in parallel, but I do think strongly that there has to be a sort of a hierarchy or I think that there's the way to get the most bang for the buck in terms of preserving biodiversity is going to be from protecting habitats.
Let's take a slight turn and talk about what has been done. Michael Archer, you've got this project, the Lazarus Project. I think that's the one in which you are bringing the frog back. How close are you to doing this?
Well, a lot closer than we expected to be when we started this project, I have to say. This is a kind of a classic cloning project, but it's different than Dolly the sheep. Dolly involved taking a live sheep body cell and using the DNA from that to put into a live sheep egg cell. And, you know, it was a miracle when it happened in 1996, but suddenly there was a cloned sheep. What we're trying to do, and so far have amazingly succeeded, at least as far as we've gotten, is to take the nucleus from a dead cell from an extinct species. We have some old frozen tissue that was shoved in a freezer between 30 and 40 years ago, and then take that dead nucleus and put it into the egg cell of a living frog of a different kind. So it's cross-species cloning. We had no reason to expect it was going to work because of all of the obvious new challenges involved. But amazingly to us, after only probably four or five hundred of these injections, one of these suddenly divided, and then it kept dividing and eventually produced an embryo that is the sort of precursor to developing a tadpole. But it didn't go on to produce a tadpole. It just stopped at that point. And that is our hurdle. We have done parallel experiments working with living frogs, so no dead tissues involved. And when we do the same things with them, they also stop at that same stage. So we suspect we've got a technological problem in front of us now, nothing to do with a problem with the extinct frog's DNA. But how long before we actually get a tadpole and a frog? You know, we're out at the edge, beyond the edge of the known in terms of doing things like this. So we don't have any signposts. We don't have any guidelines to tell us. We're just guessing. But considering we've got this far, in what amounts to basically only about a month and a half of work, albeit spread over a five-year period, I'm kind of hopeful in the next few years we're going to have this frog hopping glad to be back in the world again.
Yes.
I might add, too, one of the things that we hope to be able to do is get this frog back in the wild, and I think what John and Carl are saying are critical. We need to know that all of this effort is going to have that potential outcome, and for us that's probably going to involve selective breeding in the laboratory colony for resistance to that fungus. Many frogs around the world are starting to show this resistance, but in those cases, there are thousands of frogs. Most of them go, but a few show resistance, and the next generation breeds from those. We'd hope to be able to do that artificially in a lab so that the gastric brooding frog, which is what we're trying to get back here, that gets put back in the wild, will be able to stick its tongue out at that fungus and survive.
Suppose you're successful with this particular frog. How do you choose which animal to bring back from extinction on the next round?
There's a lot of thinking about that, and I can only say what our attitude has been in the Lazarus Project, and that is, you know, A, did we as humans drive it extinct, so that puts it on our candidate list. Two, is it a really distinctive animal? In other words, in this case, this frog represented a whole family of frogs, so it's a very unique chunk of the global genomic diversity of the world. So if we could get this back, it's not just another frog, it's a very special frog. And there's a third reason in this case, which is not necessarily applicable to all these other candidates. In this case, this frog also did something so amazing that humans are interested in understanding how it did this in order to see how it might benefit us. These frogs converted their stomach into a uterus. They raised their young in their stomach. And that was so amazing to the medical fraternity that they wanted to research this, find out how it did it, and suddenly it was extinct. So a lot of reasons why you would pick particular species to focus this attention on.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about whether or not scientists should try to bring back some extinct species through cloning. Let's go back to the ecosystem issue. John Means, when an animal goes extinct in a particular ecosystem, and we talked briefly about sometimes it collapses, sometimes it doesn't, but generally it's changed when an animal is extinct in an ecosystem. What generally happens? What kind of changes do we see? And then what would happen if you reintroduced it, say, 40 years or 400 years later?
Wow, that's tough. It's going to depend a lot, I think, on the species that you're talking about. I think it may be that in some cases, there isn't necessarily a huge impact. In other cases, some species we call keystone species, a lot of other species depend on them. And so removing them could be devastating. So it's going to vary a lot from species to species of how much overall effect they have on an ecosystem.
Carl Zimmer, would you say the scientific community is on one side or on another of this, or are they split down the middle?
I really think it's too early to say. I think for a lot of scientists, they're only becoming aware that this is actually even feasible right now. With the article in National Geographic and the meeting that was held recently for TEDx, this is really the first time that these issues have been brought up outside of, you know, a script room where somebody is coming up with the next episode of Jurassic Park. So when I talk to people, often they're just trying to think about this kind of in the hypothetical and then try to sort of move from the hypothetical to the possible. It reminds me of what was happening in the early 1970s when scientists were fiddling around with enzymes. And they realized that they could move a gene from one species into another. And so they took a gene from a frog and they stuck it into E. coli. And so suddenly you had this almost like a microbe-frog hybrid. Suddenly scientists had gone from thinking, well, this might be interesting, to seeing that this could really happen. And then suddenly the whole scientific community started getting involved in the big discussion of what would become known as genetic engineering. And that took a while. That took a few years. There were a lot of concerns raised about the possible risks and a lot of big, big promises that were made. And, you know, the big, big promises never came through. The big, big warnings never materialized. But there was something sort of in between. You know, that may be how things develop here, but we're really just at the beginning of that conversation.
One of the other phrases that I saw Michael Archer was this idea of the global genome. You've said that perhaps we conserve as much of the global genome as we can for the purpose of giving the world resilience. For the non-scientists among us, what exactly is the global genome? Is this the entirety of DNA? And does it necessarily give the world resistance?
Yeah, it's a very interesting concept. Biologically, of course, is the focus that I have. But it actually is a cultural focus. It could be an economic focus. I think all of us, no matter what discipline we're actually working in, understand that simple systems are prone to being tipped over. the less resilient the base for whatever system, whether it's cultural, economic, biological, however broad that base is, we give greater stability to what it is we depend on that's built on that base. And biological systems are pretty much the same. The more you simplify them by taking species out or by reducing the amount of diversity or space that they have to operate in, the greater the probability that a simple little push or a shove coming in from outside will tip the whole thing over. The global financial crisis was a similar thing. I think for most people in the world, we all wondered how on earth could something as catastrophic as that happen from what seemed to be simple drivers. And yet it was about simplification. It was about taking away the resilience of the system, and it can fall over. Life systems are the same. The global genome, the bigger and broader it is, the more life has, if you like, in its bag of tricks, the more capacity it has to respond to changes in the environment or changes in the world. While we are obliterating the comfortable climate zones that the planet has, we need to know life has got the toolkit to be able to respond and survive these changes. And if we've taken away a lot of its tools, more of it's going to fall over when the crisis hits.
I would like to hear John Wien's response to that. If, in fact, we can conserve this global genome and it does give the world resistance, does it give us the justification for moving forward on this kind of project?
I think that there may be two separate issues. And one is, I strongly agree with Michael, that there's a strong scientific basis for saying that more biodiverse systems, like more biodiverse ecosystems, seem to be more resilient to change. And also, they do more for us. There's this important idea of ecosystem function. And functioning natural ecosystems do so many things for us. They purify our water. They give us oxygen. They give us food. They do all these things that it would be impossible to pay for. Just a natural functioning ecosystem just does all these amazing things. And it seems to be that not only are functioning diverse ecosystems more resilient, but they also do more. They function better. So that's a strong argument for preserving biodiversity. I think it's maybe another question whether de-extincting some species is going to be a major part of that, if it's going to have enough, you know, effects on the ecosystem to make a big difference on the global scale. But I think in the end, I think we all want the same thing, is that we do want to preserve as much diversity as possible.
Michael Archer, when you de-extinct a particular, say, animal, there are a couple of concerns that have been raised. One is whether or not that animal is going to have fundamental flaws, kind of like Dolly the sheep did or others, or even when people inbreed animals, they tend to have these congenital illnesses. Is that a big risk? And then the second one is animals over time evolve and adapt to an environment socially. Is that coded in the DNA that you are then using, or is that something that is learned?
Yeah, those are fascinating questions. And of course, to a certain extent, I guess we're only going to discover these through the trial and error of doing work of this kind. In response to your first question, unquestionably, there are going to be unacceptable outcomes for some of the early experiments in de-extincting. In fact, the Pyrenean ibex this is the Bucardo, it's a goat. It was cloned nearly 10 years ago from the last individual that died, had been, in fact, hit by a tree. And the offspring from that actually came out with an extra bit of a lung, and it didn't work. But most technologies like this always start out with flaws, and then as you understand more about the processes, they get better and better with less flaws and more efficiency. Cloning is now standard in agriculture. People are doing it all the time to produce perfectly healthy cattle, arguably cattle, for example, that are even going to live longer than normal cattle. There's amazing things here. So I'm not terribly worried about that. The beginnings of these new technological things like IVF and all these other things always have hiccups to start, and then they get sorted out, and then everybody begins to take it for granted. But your second question is equally interesting. To what extent, when we bring back an extinct animal, particularly one that there may be no actual memories of how these animals behaved, supposing we do manage to get back a mammoth, are we actually going to know whether that mammoth is behaving like a mammoth or not? I'm not sure it matters too much. I do know that a lot of animal behavior is definitely hardwired into the genome. When you think about cats, you know, we don't buy adult cats. We tend to buy kittens, and they barely have their eyes open. They haven't done anything except lick their mother's milk. And yet when that kitten grows up with no training or anything else, suddenly there's all these horrible behaviors about mutilating mice. They know exactly what to do. It's hardwired behavior. My guess is we'll find that's true for most animals. We look at the animal kingdom through our own eyes, and we think about all of the behaviors we have that are learned, and we assume that's true for everything else, and it's not. About 95% of the behavior of most animals in the rest of the world is hardwired. It's instinctual. So I think if we get some of these extinct animals back, I'd expect the vast majority of those behaviors to simply click straight in.
Carl Zimmer, you get the last word.
We're talking about an extinction crisis that is affecting perhaps thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe ultimately even millions of species. And the work that's involved to bring back even one species from extinction is huge. You know, we really have to ask just how practical it can be to try to bring back these species, to figure out the biology, to work out the cloning, and all the rest, to bring back sort of a handful of species. That doesn't necessarily mean we shouldn't do it. It just might mean that we can't pretend that we could somehow make up even a tiny part of the deficit we're going to be facing. That being said, one way that de-extinction might actually prove to be very powerful might actually be really psychological. Because if people see the frog that Mike Archer is trying to bring back, or if they see a passenger pigeon, or if they see a woolly mammoth, that's going to make them think about all the species that are not with us and all the species that we're about to lose. And maybe that will lead to more of a broad-based change in people's attitudes. That's going to be what's going to let us deal with the extinction crisis.
John Weems.
You can imagine it working exactly in reverse and people saying, oh, we don't need to worry about preserving things in the wild or in zoos because we can just bring them back.
Carl Zimmer, Michael Archer, and John Weems, I'd like to extend a very big thank you for joining us on this and helping us understand this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Archer is a professor of biological, earth, and environmental sciences at the University of New South Wales. He has published more than 300 scientific journal articles focusing on the ecology and evolution of past and present and has been working to bring back some extinct animals. John Weems is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona and author of numerous publications and the book, The Ecology of Bird Communities. Carl Zimmer is an award-winning lecturer at Yale University and the author of 13 books, including his latest, A Planet of Viruses and Evolution, The Triumph of an Idea. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipranankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at armudian.